Traeger Method Podcast, episode number 80. It is 6:19 a.m. on July 8th, Saturday. I am Jason Traeger. These are the very first sound that came out of my mouth today. I've been completely silent until that tune I hummed with the opening credit. Now, if you know the podcast, you know that that version of the theme that kind of slows down and trails off in an echo delay effect, that indicates that this is a solo episode. I do not have a guest. I am the guest. I am my own guest today. Aren't we all our own guests in this life? My deathless, never born, that's you. Aren't we? Yes. I already there's these bubbling sounds coming up from within me. Mouth noises I'm conscious of. I'm not going to worry about that. This is a human being talking into a microphone. I'm in my bed. I tried making a podcast a few days ago. It was 96 degrees here in Portland, Oregon. Wasn't feeling it. Don't have AC in this place. It's a cool morning here today. It feels great. Woke up inspired to do this, feeling beautiful. I was over at my girlfriend's place. She lives about 5 minutes from where I live. Walked over here. Bird songs, birds singing in the trees. There's nothing like the morning bird song flutter. I mean, in the city here, where car noises and the noises of life and earbuds and all that stuff just blot out the bird songs, but they're in that, you know, where that 5 o'clock in the morning walking through, you know, summer, so the it's already light. The birds just, if you just tune into it, you notice they're everywhere. There's crows crowing, there's little twiddly diddles. I don't know, you know, what they are. I can't identify them. I don't have that skill, but who cares about identifying them? It's just the music of the morning that, I mean, my God, it's the best. I read somewhere that just being exposed to bird songs is therapeutic for us as human beings. And man, I believe it. Happy to be alive here on this morning. We lost Rick Froberg. I mean, that's what our language says. We say we lost, he died. I don't know what any of that actually means. To many people, it means, oh, there will be no more art. There will be no more music. I'm trying to get the words out again. My vocal cords are just warming up here. There will be no more art. There will be no more music. That is the end of the catalog. It's done. Unless there's unreleased things, but there's nothing new will be produced. You know, to certain people, that's what it means. To someone like me, he's not going to be on the podcast. I thought we were going to have him back very soon. He was on my list. He was on episode 15 at the very beginning. I was hoping to have him back in the next few months when the Hot Snakes album, new one, came out. Check back in with Rick. I was really looking forward to that. So that's not going to happen. But in a way, he's appearing now because we're talking about him in this episode's. It's kind of the centerpiece theme of this episode is thinking about Rick and all the other things that shoot off of that event of him dying. I've been thinking about him a lot and thinking about my own trajectory and the parallel. You know, we're the same age, pretty much. He was a couple months older than me, but similar age. And we, you know, our paths crossed. I mean, the bulk of our time spent together was in our teenage years back in North County, San Diego. But, you know, when somebody dies that's like really close to your own age and you have a sort of similar trajectory, art, music, I mean, he's a much more well-known person in both those fields, of course. But, you know, similar stuff, similar community, you know, it hits you in a certain way. Sad to see him go, but I celebrate his life. My heart goes out to all the people in his immediate circle, family members, his stepmom, dad, brothers, all his collaborators, John Reese, lifelong collaborator. My heart goes out to you, Leah. I know you were very close. I'd speak to people as though they're listening. I don't know whether or not people are listening, but I send out my love and my respect and, you know, all my goodwill to all the people that loved Rick, that knew him well, and all the fans of his music, Drive Like Jehu, The Obits, Pitchfork, Hot Snakes, his art. He was a masterful draftsman, drawer. His ability to work with, you know, I'm an artist myself. I have great admiration for, especially artists who work with the black and white. That's his primary. And when I think of his work, I think of that. His ability to navigate negative and positive space, black and white, excuse me. I let the song of my body into this podcast. You may have noticed that. And it might be something that keeps people from wanting to listen, that I burp on air, but I just don't want to edit all that stuff out all the time. So you hear me breathing, you hear me making mouth noises, and you hear me burping occasionally. Sorry. Sorry, not sorry. But yeah, he was masterful at that. The dance of the blacks and whites, the opposites. His output was tremendous. You know, when in episode 20, no, episode 2015, it was episode 15 in the year 2020 or 2021, I can't remember. One of the very first podcast episodes, 15, early on. In that conversation, he talks about his compulsion to make music. He was compelled to do so. Music meant so much to him. It changed his life. It was magic. And he just was compelled to give back or to just feed into that stream. You know, Rick, of course, had a dark side. He was a, you know, I related to him when I was young because we were both, when I encountered him, got to know him, he was like a kindred spirit. You know, we both had some kind of a wound. Both had that artistic drive. He seemed kind of like, to me back then when I met him, he was, you know, seemed like a guy from the Pacific Northwest. He was less a San Diego kind of guy to me. Definitely not less surfer. But he was a BMX guy. We talk about BMX on that pod mostly, on that episode 15 pod. But yeah, he was, you know, I was thinking about his family. I know his mom wasn't in the picture. He had a stepmom, a dad. His dad had another family. He had three brothers from his stepmom. So there was a mother wound there. Again, I don't know what it was, but I had a mother wound, less severe. You know, when my folks got divorced, my mom left. And I don't mean she abandoned us. I mean, she is the one who moved out, not my dad. I ended up staying at my dad's house. Mom wanted to go back to college to get a degree so she could, you know, support herself. So that was what was practical for her to do, which, of course, as an adult today, I totally get. But to my four-year-old self, no. It was something that I had, you know, yeah, deep wound from. Not as bad as what other people go through, but it was my wound. And I had to deal with that. And mother wounds, man, those are hard ones. And I really get the sense it was for Rick. I don't know what I'm getting at with that. I'm just saying that I had a lot of compassion for him. And, you know, I think his, you know, relatively early, I like to think of 55 as an early departure. I don't like to think of this as like it's coming for me tomorrow, but, you know, maybe it is. Who knows? But, you know, I didn't know Rick well in the recent years. You know, that podcast episode we did was reuniting, and it was wonderful to get back in touch with him, and I really liked being back in touch with him these past couple of years. But what am I getting at? Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't know that he ever got past, you know, the alcohol, cigarettes and all that stuff. You know, there was a certain sort of, you know, I don't know, self-destructive element in him that probably came from some sort of a core trauma or pain. I'm just speculating here, but yeah, so I have a great deal of compassion towards him for that, because I know how hard that is. And I think it's also real tribute to a person when, in spite of their, whatever you want to call it, darkness, they're able to produce so much beauty and share it with the world. And so for that, I absolutely salute Rick for all the work he did to share, and that I know, I mean, obviously has affected the lives of many, many, many people. Hordes of people. Legions. I mean, I've been reading the tributes like anybody else who's in this zone. And I've been getting messages from folks, listeners, who remember that I had that podcast with Rick and knew that I knew him. So they'd written to me to say, you know, how much his music meant to them. And I really appreciated those testimonies that I received. Thank you, Traeger Method listeners. JB, thank you for sharing yours. Yeah, it's beautiful, the impact art has on people's lives. And I think, you know, Rick's impulse to give back that he described in our conversation, it's a wonderful thing. You give, you get. That's what art and music's all about. That's what the Traeger Method podcast is all about. I get, I give, I get, I give, I give, I get. Thank you for listening. Thank you so much for supporting the pod. Thank you for telling a friend. I appreciate it so much. I say that every episode. I'm saying it again. Did you hear that crow outside? Bird songs. Yeah, but I've been thinking a lot about Rick and a lot about that time, our teenage years, that period in our teenage years where we were friends together. Been talking with old friends, Sean Kelly, Don Ankrum, Sarah Utter, people who knew Rick. It's been a major theme of my these last days since he did die. Thinking about North County memories, Encinitas, Leucadia, downtown Encinitas. What a cool place that was. Back then, Lou's Records, the apartments above Lou's. Well, but in the olden days, Encinitas was a little beach town. And then on the other side of the Pacific Coast Highway, there were flower fields. That was, you know, in the olden days, the 60s, 50s, or whatever, and before. But, you know, by the time I lived there, it was the other side of the Pacific Coast Highway was housing developments, tract homes, strip malls, all that stuff. And the I-5 was also over there. Rick grew up or was from Carlsbad, which is just north of Encinitas. Well, there's, if you go up the coast highway from San Diego, you know, it's like roughly speaking, there's like La Jolla, Cardiff, Solana Beach, Del Mar, I'm not maybe going in exact order, but then Encinitas, then Leucadia, where I lived. Then above that is Carlsbad. Then above that, Oceanside. You keep going up, you get to the Marine base, Camp Pendleton. San Onofre, the nuclear tits. Do you remember that from the Descendants song? Drive past the nuclear tits. In the Descendants song, I don't know what song that is. I can't remember, but they, they're referring to San Onofre, which is it's a nuclear reactor or whatever, and it's got two dome-shaped breast-like structures with flashing red nipples on top, little lights up there. So you get up there, that's then you get into, you know, Orange County, Los Angeles above that. So that's my trip up the Coast Highway. But Rick was from Carlsbad, just up the way. I can't remember exactly how we met, but he was a fan of the Leading Edge fanzine that we did, Martin Sprouse, Pat Weakland, Greg Lippman, and I, which had been around a while. Rick got into punk a little after I did. In episode 15, he talks about his first show was Anthrax and Raven at the Adams Avenue Theater, which, yes, technically was not a punk show. It was a metal show. But it was a punk metal show in the sense that it was at Adams Avenue Theater, and it was put on by punk promoter Tim Mays of the Casbah and all that, later of the Casbah fame, and just San Diego, you know, promoter. So it was a punk show, and I'd say the audience was mostly punk. There weren't a lot of, you know, like the kids at my school who went and saw Kiss and stuff, they were not at this show. This was a punk show. Rick was at that one. This is his first show. I had been going to shows for a few years prior to that. But anyways, we're the same age, but I was in punk a little earlier. And doing stuff a little earlier. I did the, you know, we were doing the fanzine. Rick was into that. He put out his fanzine. He talks about that in our conversation. Two issues of Subculture. Really cool fanzine. Well made. It was good. Nobody gave a damn about it, so he stopped doing it. And of course, so I don't remember. Maybe we had written to one another beforehand. We met somehow. Did I introduce Rick to Don and John and the Pitchfork guys? Or did they? I don't remember. I'd have to talk to people. I should have a guest. I should talk to Don and try and triangulate these things. I'd love to talk to John too later when you know, this aftermath of this event is a little in the distance. Man, my heart goes out to John. Rick and John have been playing music together in different forms 40 years, almost. It's insane. It's beautiful. I was out, what am I saying? Yeah, so I'm talking about the past, how we met, how they met, not knowing exactly what the timeline was. But whatever the case, we became friends. I remember going up to Rick's house in Carlsbad. We did our BMX thing together, fixing up our bikes, riding BMX around, finding spots to do stuff. We shared that. I didn't know anybody else. He didn't know anybody else that was into BMX before punk. And so we got really into that. And I don't know. I just really liked Rick. I remembered also that we had this, there was this girl that we were both super into. And we were, like I said, we were kind of similar in certain ways, like in that we were both artists and sensitive, you know, music loving people. You know, we kind of had the poetic spirit in us. And we both had, we're in love with this girl. I ended up going out with her. And you'd think, okay, I won the battle, the teenage battle of love. And I felt a little competition towards Rick, like he's not as great as, you know, pick me, you know. But anyway, she did pick me. But then she ended up she had this boyfriend, a long distance boyfriend who lived in another city in Las Vegas. He was an older guy, quite a bit older than us, almost scandalously so. And just from a punk trivia aspect, he was also in a punk band, a famous punk band, a punk band that did stuff. They were on the Boston Not LA compilation. That's all I will say. He was in that band. I won't say who, what, because I don't know, it's probably too much to divulge since I'm talking about personal stuff. But yeah, there was a punk angle there too, about which I will say no more. But they ended up getting pregnant. He got her pregnant. She got pregnant with him. While I was still totally in love with her, and we, oh man, talk about teenage torment. That was just before I left to move to San Francisco or to Reno to be with some, maybe that's, I don't know. I can't even remember. Whatever the case, Rick got off easy by not being the guy who was dating her while she got pregnant by the other guy. That's weird to think that her daughter that she had then is now like probably almost, well, she's not probably, if she's alive, she's probably 38 years old now or something like that. Like I could have, if I had gotten her pregnant then, I would have a nearly 40-year-old daughter now. What? Yeah, that's a thing. How would my life be different? How, I can't even, God, incomprehensible. But anyways, I wish her well. I wish her daughter well. I hope they're all doing well. So yeah, when I think of Rick in that time, I remember that there, the apartments above Lou's Records, right there in downtown, well, you know, the old Encinitas along the Coast Highway, beautiful area. It was a nice little cluster down there, very idyllic in certain ways. You got Lou's Records across the street with the La Paloma Theater, this beautiful old theater. I don't know when that was built, 20s or something. Movies, concerts, shows, you know. I know Pitchfork played there. Did they play there with Fugazi? I think I've seen a flyer of that. Fugazi and Pitchfork at the La Paloma Theater. Wish I'd been there for that. I was in the Bay Area by that time. There was also Blue Moon Music, I think was the name of it, across the street. It might still be there. Guitar Shop. That was the place I bought my first guitar, or second one, I guess. I had a PVT-60 or something that I bought from a garage sale or something, which turned out to be great guitars, I guess. Now they're like sought after expensive guitars. You know, they're like $800 or something. But at the time I was like, this guitar is terrible looking, you know, it's just not cool. No, it's a PVT-60 is just not a cool looking guitar, even though it's like a quality guitar instrument, you know. But my first cool guitar was a Gibson SG that I bought at Blue Moon Music on layaway, or whatever you call it when you pay little installments. It was like, and this is funny, 60s or 70s SG, if you know guitars at all, $300. I don't know what that would be worth now. $3,000? I don't know. But anyways, I was, $300 seemed epic. It was like climbing a mountain. I was making $3 an hour as a busboy at Borelli's Pizza, Italian restaurant. So I'd go in there, here's $25. Keep paying it off until finally, and I'd go in there and play it. They had a little practice room in the back where somebody did lessons, taught lessons. Could I take it back there and play for a little while? Play it a little while. I think the only song I could ever play back then was Nervous Breakdown. Or no. Yeah, Nervous Breakdown. And a little bit of a rock and roll turnaround. So go back there and do that, but whatever the case. I eventually bought the guitar and was able to take it home. My Angus Young Brown SG from Blue Moon Music. I also bought a Dan Armstrong, you know, a la Greg Ginn, a clear Lucite Dan Armstrong guitar they had there. $200, I remember. They were like, we can't give this thing away. Nobody wants this. This is the, you know, 80s where like the cool guitar was the Charvel Jackson, you know, Paul Reed Smith, I think, had just come out. You know, that those are like, those are the sought after guitars. Nobody wanted vintage stuff, which is weird to think of. It's like, you want the latest gear. You want the coolest hair metal stuff. And this guy was like, you don't want this guitar. You can't even set the intonation. Because those Dan Armstrongs just have this little wooden, if you don't know guitars, you probably, you don't know what I'm talking about. Intonation, it's the length of the strings. You set them so that you can tune it or something like that. But Dan Armstrong's just got this wooden strip kind of where the strings go over it down at the base of the strings where they're. Anyways, this is probably not the kind of remembrance stuff you guys want to hear, but I got one of those guitars, $200. It was incredible. I was so stoked on it. And I'm sad I got rid of it, probably traded it for an equal amount for some other guitar that I don't even care about. But that was a beautiful, beautiful guitar. I'm not a materialist, but I do wish I still had that one. Okay, where was I? My girlfriend is texting me about we're going to the ocean today. About our plans. She's texting me. Where was I? So Rick, when I think of that area, Blue Moon Music's across the street. There's other little nice businesses. There's a nice little part of Encinitas that I really enjoyed. Leucadia had its charm too, just up the way. Juanita's taco shop being the main thing that I loved. I remember going there with Rick quite a bit. I hope Juanita's is still there. I think it is. It's an institution, I hope. So good. Such fond memories of that. But yeah, so there was the apartments above Lou's. I can't remember who had the apartment. Simon from Crash Worship? Marcus, maybe? It was a cool scene. Go up there, put on the Dream Machine, that psychic TV thing where it's like a paper cutout thing that had these holes in it, and you'd put it on a turntable with a light in the middle, and then you'd turn on the turntable, and you'd sit there with your eyes closed. And something about the rhythm of the light that would come through these holes as the paper turned on the turntable. You would have your eyes closed and the light, the holes would, you know, project light onto your eyelids in a certain rhythm that was supposed to achieve some kind of brainwave thing. Do you know what I'm talking about? I think it was called a Dream Machine. I should Google that. I don't know what that was supposed to do, honestly, but I remember sitting there doing that up there. I don't know why that's a memory. Yeah, and I just remember hanging out up there, the Lou's apartments. Now, how Rick came to be in Pitchfork or to know those guys, I would have to ask Don. I did hang out with Don the other day. I hang out with Don quite a bit. Don Ankrum, who has been on the podcast at least once before. He'll definitely be back soon. We'll talk about this stuff. We go for walks quite regularly. He lives here in Portland. We've played music together. We do things together. Don just brought me some lettuce from his garden yesterday and some squash. Thank you, Don. Don's awesome. Yeah, so he was in Pitchfork with Rick and John, Joey Pirro. They actually were a band before Rick joined for like a year. The three of them played together. John had been in Conservative Itch? And then Pitchfork, I can't say how exactly they got together, but I was there at the very beginning. I remember their very first practices being there. And I was kind of like, I played guitar, but you know, I was like, meh. I'm not going to try and start a band here because I'm moving. I wanted to get out of San Diego. I was just very like set on like, I got to get out of here. I wasn't from there. It was just a place I lived for a while. High school. I had my eyes set on, my sights set on San Francisco. I don't know the exact timeline. Did I go to Reno? I went to Reno first. I came back. I think it was when I was back briefly between my 7 seconds Reno time and then moving to the Bay Area, like fully. There was a period where I was back in San Diego. I think that was the Pitchfork era that I was present for. I remember being at their practices in Encinitas. I think they practiced at Joey Pirro's house, the drummer, who wasn't really a punk. He was just kind of a dude who played drums. That's my memory of him. And then there was practice sessions or recording, like early demo, maybe attempts at John's house down in Pacific Beach. I remember being at some of those. Remember John had a cassette multi-track recording deck. It was a big one, like, I don't know, 8 or 16 track cassette deck. thing, and then he had just gotten some money from something, a little teenage windfall, and he bought a Randall solid state head. So he had like a half stack, this cassette recording thing. John knew what he wanted to do. He was just very on it. And, you know, paid off. Lifelong musician, legend of music. Achieved. Congratulations, John. And kudos to you on all the music. Very talented and awesome dude who I have not been in touch with, but I'd like to. Like I said, I'd love to have John on the pod eventually when it's good. So yeah, and I think I was faking that I knew something about recording. I kind of had a little bullshit streak in me, maybe, or maybe I did know something, but I remember them kind of being like, how does this, he couldn't get the thing to work. He didn't know how to record. And I was like, well, yeah, you press this and you do that. Maybe I had a little bit of a, I'm more of a, I've been around punk longer. I kind of know more about stuff. So I just remember putting socks over the microphones, like, this is going to keep it from popping, which is legit. I don't know if socks actually work, but the idea of a pop filter, that's a real thing. I knew that somehow. It's weird memories, right? How they're just these weird snapshots. Like, why do I remember putting socks over a microphone at a Pitchfork cassette recording session? I remember that. That's a detail. Now, I think this, all that I'm talking about, was before Rick was in the band. I think this was that year, in the year, because I don't remember seeing them like in this time with Rick singing. I think this was just the three of them. But I do remember seeing, God, did Pitchfork open for Fugazi's like first show at Gilman in like 87, 88? I think that was the case. And I believe I probably had some jealousy about that. Like, wow, these guys are actually doing it, you know? Because I always wanted to play music in bands and stuff. But I didn't. I don't know how to do that back then. I didn't know. I just didn't know how. And I was maybe too self-conscious. It was never good enough or the right thing. Or I don't know what it was. I can't analyze that, but I remember, yeah, them being up there being, well, like, they get to play with Fugazi, and I don't know. But whatever the case, I remember being like, they're good. And I was also proud. I was also like, yeah, these are my high school pals, you know? They're doing it. I think that's a real memory. I do remember very much at that show, I believe this was the first time I ever saw Fugazi, Gilman, first tour. I remember when they did Waiting Room, and I was like, whoa. This is going to, like, this is a song nobody's heard before. They don't have did they have the EP out already? The 12 inch, the red one, maybe, whatever the case, people lost their shit. Like Gilman, you know, when you see an entire room where every single person in the room, maybe there was some dud in the back who was standing with his arms folded, but, or her arms folded, their arms folded. But, you know, the vibe was that every single person in the room was losing their shit at the same time when Waiting Room, you know, went into the breakdown part. But yeah, Pitchfork was awesome too, if memory serves me. And then later on in the San Francisco years, I'd see, you know, Drive Like Jehu. I remember they played at this place just down the street from where I lived on, oh God, I can't remember the name of the street. Oh man, wow, that is faded. Fulton Street. Yes, I still got it. Lived on Fulton Street, and there was this little bar down the street called the Grapevine. It was kind of a soul R&B club. And I remember Rick called me. This is my memory that he called me. It's like, yeah, we're playing in San Francisco. I'm like, where? He's like, the Grapevine. I was like, I literally can see it from my window. I'll be there. We hung out. And yeah, and that was what show. They were so good. I remember thinking, wow, the two of them together, like John and Rick, their guitars, the way they were intertwined. I was like, yeah, okay, wow, this is good. So yeah, they're good, you know, the way that their guitars dance together and weave, it's awesome. The Grapevine, that place, that was the first shooting I ever saw, like, was at that club. I remember one night, it was weird, because I was out in front of my, no, I was looking out the window for some reason. I think there was a bunch of commotion. Yeah, that's what it was. There was a bunch of commotion, a crowd of people in the street. And, you know, I'm looking, so I looked out the window and I looked down the street at the Grapevine and I watched this guy sort of walk away from the crowd. And then he turned around with a gun and just opened fire, just pop, 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 pop into the crowd. And I was like, just watching it going, whoa, okay. That's America, right? Your first shooting. I've seen, like, I don't know. I'm not laughing, but I'm doing that jaundiced laugh, huh? You know, I've seen several since then. Never been shot, though. Thank you. But yeah, that was shocking. That's a Grapevine story. That apartment on Fulton Street, hardwood floors, two bedroom, roof access, beautiful windows. $600, I think I remember. Star and I paid for that place. $300 a piece. I was like, whoa, we're adults now. That's a lot of money. That's also the apartment where I, to this day, I sleep with my head sandwiched between two pillows. I put a pillow on top of my head and there's one below it. That started at that apartment. Because we moved in and we were like, this place is amazing. It's so great. Look at these, you know, the sunlight, the hardwood floors. It wasn't until we moved in and we slept our first night there, I realized, oh yeah, Fulton Street's like a busy street with like a bus line that's very active. Constant traffic with the hardwood floors. It just echoed. It was so much street noise, traffic noise. I was like, I will not be able to sleep. So I started sandwiching my head with the pillows. And I do that to this day. And here I am, 30 something years later. I'm living in an apartment next to a busy street. It's pretty quiet right now because it's, you know, 7 in the morning on a weekend. But yeah. In certain ways I progress. In the ways that matter, I've been progressing, but in terms of my material existence, not tremendously, you know, still in the apartment on the busy street, which is fine. It's okay. I thank God I have this place. I love it. But yeah, those are just some things that come to mind. I will have guests in future days. I want to have Sean Kelly back on. I want to have Don back on. Other people that knew Rick, we'll be talking about him in the future, funny stories and associations, and I'll try and triangulate some of those historical things just for the record, or whatever that means. But yeah. And also, I wanted to point you guys towards the tour stories. The Tour Stories podcast that Joe Plummer does, the great drummer, Joe Plummer, the Plummer drummer. He has an episode out right now that is a tribute to Rick Froberg that is just Rick's music. And I don't have any Rick music on this episode, so I'm going to send you over to the Tour Stories podcast, support that podcast and Joe's work over there, and listen to the music of Rick via Joe's playlist. So that's these are partner podcasts. Joe doesn't know it, but this is a partner podcast to that one. I'm sure there'll be many episodes celebrating Rick of different ones, different podcasts, but so far that's the only one I know about, and it's a good one to just listen to the music. So Tour Stories, link in show notes. Now I will muse on death in general and my perspective on death. What is it? Who knows? What is life? Who knows? We talk about this stuff like we know something about it. We don't. You know, we die every night when we go to sleep, dreamless sleep. What's the difference between that and death? Nothing. You know, you're not there. There's no you. There's no thoughts. There's no stories. Just nothingness. Not even nothingness, because there's nothing to compare it to. There's no comparison going on. There's no person there to compare it to something, you know? So you can't even say it's nothing. It's just pure silence. What is death for you? You know, you say, well, it's the same thing. But no, it's not. Because death for you is just an idea in the imagination now. Always ahead, suspended ahead, in the future. Never here, always coming, always impending, always in the imagination, just like now. You know, I say this stuff a lot in different ways, but today I'm saying it this way. You know, we talk about life as though we know what it is. We say, you know, there's the past, there's the present, and there's the future. That's life. But nobody can find the place where the past stops and the present starts and the future, you know, then begins. You can't ever find those dividing lines. But we just brush past that. We say, that's nothing to worry about. There's a past, there's a present, and there's a future, you know? Talking about Rick 30 years ago, 40 years ago, that was the past. Sure. Worrying about my death someday in the future, that's the future, right? Worrying about the future of life on Earth, of the society, that's the future. You put it like, you know, 2 years from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, whatever, you know, that feels like the future. You know, 20 years ago, that really feels like the past. But, you know, where does that actually begin? Where does it actually end? You can't find it. You know, we say, be here now, find now. You can't. You know, and so our own death is that. Our own life is that. And then the deaths of others, you know, a dream character exits the dream. There's no more music from Rick. We can't hang out with him. We can't hang out with our dog after he died. It's sad. We look at the stuff left behind. The dog bed, my dog is doing perfectly fine, but you know what I'm saying? I'm just talking about death in general. You know, you look at the dog bed and the toys and you just want to cry. You know, the toys aren't going to be played with anymore. The dog's not going to wear his little sweater. You know, and we mourn. That's where mourning comes in. Perhaps you might mourn, you know, especially the people, the creatures that are closest to you. The ones that are integrated into your day-to-day life, your children, spouses. You know, I hesitate to even think about that. My girlfriend has been having, and when I call her my girlfriend, she's, you know, she's my life. I mean, I love her. I mean, she's my life partner. I've never, you know, I just don't believe in marriage for myself. I just don't care about that. So, you know, but I'm absolutely dedicated to her. So she's, you know, central person in my life. She has been having a little bit of this like heart palpitations recently, and it just occurred to me, like, she's quite a bit younger than me. I was just thinking she's 38 years old, which is the exact age that my daughter would be had I gotten that girl pregnant back in Encinitas, which is it's weird to think about. But anyway, she's quite a bit younger than me, so I've always had this, I was saying this to her just yesterday, I always had this sense with her that, like, she's eternal, because I will definitely die before she does. So in my mind, she's an eternal being in the body. Like, she will always be alive as long as I am. Like, there's certain people I go, that person will die before me. This is just, you know, the way we think about life. We sort of assume these things. But then, you know, she was having this little like heart palpitation thing, and she went to the doctor yesterday, and she's fine, I think, you know. It's not like a huge thing. It's just something to look at. But you know, it just like occurred to me when we were talking about this. I was like, God, it's possible you could die before me. Which I just don't even like entertaining the thought of that. I like to live in the assumption that I will never have to deal with that because I'm going to be gone. She'll have to deal with me dying. That's, you know, that's the way but then you realize, no, nothing's written in stone. Nothing's just, you know, you got to go with the flow. You know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, the idea of the death of a child to a parent is like the most tragic thing, because nobody want, you know, that's like not the order it's supposed to go in. We go, no, it's the other way. I die first, then the child. Then they carry on, then they have kids, then their kids live past them, they die, and that's the way life is, and everything's fine and dandy. No child should die. No young person, no parent should lose a child. But it's just, that's because it goes against the order that we expect. And the same thing goes with projecting like how long a person should live. Like, you know, Rick dying at 55, you know, to me, that seems really young. But I personally don't see a long life as a good life or a good life as a long life. You know, there's plenty. I mean, Henry Kissinger is 100. Is that a good life? Not to me. You know, people die at, you know, young. It's not, it's tragic in the sense of how it affects us, you know, other people. But for them, it's not tragic. You know, we live as with this idea that there's a thing that was supposed to happen in this other dimension, all this other stuff happened. You know, if Hendrix had lived to be 60, we would have had so much more music. That's just not how it is. That's just the imagination, wishing or something. I don't know. I mean, I realized that I used to have a belief about myself that was like, I will not die as long as I have not made great art that affects people's life. And this is a, you know, long time ago, whatever, and in my old way of thinking, I am destined to create art that will touch the lives of many, many people. Music, art that will live on in memory and will be celebrated. And until I achieve that, which is my destiny, I cannot die. And then a concurrent belief was that once I do achieve that, I will die. You know, it'll be a death sentence. So there was this fear, like if I do create the thing and share the thing, my true radiant beauty, my true brilliance, then I will die. If I don't, I will live forever. So it was this kind of weird tension. And this is just crazy belief of mine. Nothing to do with any reality that I know of. But it was just, I don't know, a kind of weird tug of war between fear and desire, you know. Just one of those weird things that we do with these games we kind of play. That it's good to, or like that thing with my girlfriend, like she's going to live forever because I'm going to die before her. These are just beliefs we have that are good to investigate and check. And just generally speaking, like I say a lot on the pod, just remember, it's all thoughts. Good ones, bad ones, fantasies, projections, realistic things, magical thinking. It's all thoughts, all of them. Practical ones, thoughts. Flights of fancy, thoughts. It's thoughts, the mind doing its thing. You are not the mind. You are not the body. I was at Sean Kelly's birthday the other day. We had a nice get together. Sarah Lund was there. Chelsea, CJ. Lily and Sarah's boyfriend, partner, whatever. And Sarah, drummer of Unwound, you know who Sarah is, right? I want to have her on the pod at some point. Anyways, we were all just sitting around the table, just had a name drop. Sarah from Unwound, she just got back from a tour of Europe. She just did the Primavera Festival, you know, Sarah. Yeah, she's an old friend. She's a good friend. I love her. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I know her. I know Rick Froberg. I know Sarah. I'm cool. Chelsea and CJ. Chelsea, Snowmade Productions, if you know her work. You got to check out Chelsea's stuff, Snowmade. She does beautiful laser cut magnets and all kinds of things. She has a very successful woman-owned, awesome business, sustainable, I'm sure. Great vision, great messages come from her, Snowmade. I'll put a link to that. Anyways, Chelsea was there. We were all there sitting around. Chelsea was making these watermelon cocktails. Sean was getting lit. We were all talking about, it's his birthday. Lucy, his wife, was at work. She's a nurse. Baby Wren was asleep. And we were talking about this stuff. AI, and Chelsea and CJ were kind of like, I don't know if AI is going to destroy the world or not. Sean was like, it absolutely will, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going, you know, all this projection about like the death of the planet. You know, I struggled with this stuff for, you know, my great depression of like a couple of years ago, whatever that was, winter of 2021. That was the end of that for me. I got to the end of the whole, like, we're going to all die in a fascist civil war and the planet's going to, you know, overheat and we're all just going to die. And it's just going to be a horrible apocalypse and humanity's doomed and AI Terminator future's coming. You know, I just took that to its, you know, end and was like, okay, I'm miserable. I am just bereft. What hope is there? And then I burst through it into this new way of being that I currently experience, that I live with now every day. And that is just saying, hey, I am infinity. I am life itself. I said that at the party and everybody kind of laughed, you know, but I was like, no, I want to explain like what I really mean when I say that. Because it sounds grandiose and insane to say I am life itself. But what I mean when I say that is the opposite of grandiosity. It's I'm not saying I, Jason Traeger, am life itself. I'm saying, you know, if I look at my actual experience, it's not my life. It's not the Jason Traeger show is my life. I go, no, my actual experience is just life. All concept of quote unquote life is experienced in this life, my life, quote unquote. There's no like, you know, big picture life going on elsewhere that's like the full life and then I get my little section of it. No. All that life is this. And it's what I actually am. And if you look at your own experience, you'll notice you too are life. Take away the story, take away the little thought clusters, take away the you know, particulars. And you'll notice, oh yeah, you know, the history of Rome is your history of Rome. The pyramids of Egypt are your pyramids of Egypt. The sky is your sky. The trees, the bird songs are your bird songs. You are those bird songs. You know, that's an idea like that you might toss around. It's not you experiencing bird songs in the morning when you walk home at 5 a.m. on a summer morning. You know, you are those bird songs. You are this surrounding. Taking one step further, you're beyond even those. What's going on out there? Did you hear that? Okay, now this just inspired me. I just thought about it this for a second. I paused and I thought, okay, I remember a few episodes ago, I don't know what podcast episode it was, but I mentioned something about my ayahuasca death experience. And I was like, I should talk about that. I just remember putting a little note on it and saying, I should talk about that someday. Well, I'm going to talk about that right now. That's what I'm going to end this episode on. I have done ayahuasca. Well, I've, you know, been in four ayahuasca ceremonies in my life. And I don't know which one this was. I think it was the third one I did. And this was a three evening night day ceremony. And on the second night, there was a person there who works with Mapacho, which is the Amazonian tobacco. It's like a pure Amazonian tobacco. It's like 25 times stronger than cigarette tobacco. And it's often or always involved in some way with ayahuasca ceremonies. It's kind of the root shamanic plant of the Amazon and much of the New World. For more information about ayahuasca tobacco and all that, Plants of the Gods. No, wait a sec. Yeah, Plants of the Gods. I think that's the name of the podcast. I'll have a link to it. Mark Plotkin. Dr. Mark Plotkin's podcast. That's a good one. There's an excellent episode about tobacco and shamanism in the Amazon. Like I said, I will put a link in it. I will put a link in the show notes to that episode. Well, you know, the ayahuasca ceremony, I grew up from my early 20s on, I did a lot of psilocybin mushrooms, mostly in the Terence McKenna style that he was the only advocate I really knew back then and who gave advice as pre-internet, about how to do mushrooms, how to approach them. And his thing was silent darkness, 5 dried grams or more silent darkness by yourself. If you have a sitter, have them be in the other room, just available to call on if you have a problem. And that was never had that though, but I found that was the way, if you have other people there, they can just infect your trip. You want to just do it by yourself, silent darkness, go inward, see what the mushroom has to say. But ayahuasca is a different deal. Ayahuasca is like, you're with a group. There's elements driving, there's musical driving, there's other performance elements. Sometimes in my experience, I think that's usually the case, always together. You're with the person who's running the ceremony, other people who are taking the medicine. There's also things like tobacco, which is often, blown over the body like a cigarette. You don't smoke it, but a rolled tobacco thing that somebody will cleanse you with. There's jape, which is the Amazonian snuff, which has tobacco in it often, almost always. That is administered at certain points in the ceremony. There's flower water, agua de Florida, copal, palo santo can be burned in different places, all to kind of work with the medicine and guide the trip in certain ways. That's an element of the ayahuasca experience, this group collective thing, which is very different than my past experiences with, like I just described, psilocybin. And I had always thought that since you're not huffing the tobacco, you are in the sense when you take the jape, but you're not like smoking the cigarette, you're not inhaling big puffs of this tobacco. Like I said, it's super strong. It's a big subject, but this was my impression as a novice. I was like, I thought it was kind of in the realm, tobacco use was kind of in the realm of incense or this Palo Santo and that kind of thing. A scent, a thing you get whiffs of that, is just meant to guide and stuff, but not really a central part of the experience. But anyways, this guy who was at the ceremony, he was like, that's his thing, Mapacho. You know, he described it as like ayahuasca is the mother, Mapacho is the grandfather. You know, she's the grandmother, he's the grandfather. The two work together. So anyways, he had offered, you know, if anybody is called to do this Mapacho suplato, like this blessing during the ceremony, you know, he was like, come over and tap me on the shoulder. And if the time is right, we'll go out there and do it out in the patio. So at a certain point, I think it was the second night, I had the calling, you know, ayahuasca, the medicine said, now's the time, go get the suplato, go get the tobacco, the Mapacho. So he and I went out on this back deck, and the light was waning. It was the, you know, evening. This was in the summer or spring. And he began doing this blessing he had this pipe with this large bowl, a bunch of Mapacho in it, smoking it. I'm pretty deep in the medicine, but ayahuasca is really interesting because it'll really turn on and off if you need it to. Like, you can be in deep psychedelic states, but then if you need to urinate, it's just like turns off. You go to the bathroom, do your thing, completely steady, totally fine. You lay back down, boom, it comes right back. It's amazing. But so we go out there and I'm just fine, steady on my feet. Everything's normal, as normal as it can be when you're on ayahuasca. And we're looking at each other and he's explaining to me, you know, like, okay, just stand there and you don't have to do anything. I will do this blessing. And he was speaking in Quechua, I think. And he started blowing this, you know, puffing on this bowl until it was really going. And there's all sorts of, you know, a lot of smoke coming out, and he's blowing it over my shoulders and he's saying these blessings, blowing it over my forehead. And it just starts getting more and more intense, just more and more energy. Just, I could feel it just moving up through my feet. There's this vibrating, powerful, incredible feeling. And he keeps going and it's just getting more and more intense until I say to him, like, I have to sit down. I'm going to fall over the power of this Mapacho all around me. And so I do, I sit down. He's like, fine. You know, so I sit down in this lawn chair and I'm, you know, just the heaviest feeling in my limbs, you know, they're like, they're just have weights on them. My feet are just lead, you know, and he's continuing, just going and going, you know, saying these prayers and blowing this tobacco and blowing it up my pant legs, up my sleeves, until I'm just sitting there with the smoke pouring out of my clothes. You know, this is the sensation I had. I'm just radiating the smoke up to the heavens, you know, and I'm completely overwhelmed. It just gets to the breaking point where, boom, I'm just gone. Totally gone. You could call it passing out. You could call it fainting. You call it whatever you want. I'm not there anymore. Pure nothingness. Beyond nothingness. Nothing with no opposite of it. Dreamless sleep, death, nothingness. I don't even notice going there. How can you notice it? There's no one there to notice it. Total peace. No conflict, no nothing, no opposites, no consciousness, no thoughts. Gone. Or totally present, however you want to see it. The only thing I can share is the return. Since I don't have any memory of the leaving, just what preceded it, this smoky cloud, then I'm gone into that pure state, pure awareness, whatever you want to call it. But then the return is what was spectacular. The return was this. I'm open-eyed. It's day, you know, it's light out. Late evening, light. I'm looking with my eyes open and I just see these several shapes. These sort of blobs, flat blobs, each one with these perfect color combinations. Like one blob is, and they're covered in symbols and patterns, and they're, and each blob is like got a color cord, you know, like peach, purple, gray, green, and blue, or whatever, just like some perfectly harmonious, elegant cord of colors. And the next blob above it has, and they're all like kind of meeting, you know, like a puzzle where each piece has a totally different color cord and set of symbols. And then another one has a different one, and another, and they're just sitting there and that filling my vision. And I'm going, okay, totally fine. Feel totally fine. Not scared at all. Not freaked out. And I'm just looking at them going, okay, this is interesting, or whatever. And then as I'm sitting there, they slowly start moving towards one another, like overlapping. And then they progressively get a little faster until they zoom over one another, like lenses suddenly overlapping, or color filters, you know? And then as they overlap, boom, zap, I'm back in reality. This, you know, everyday waking reality, the world around me. So it was like I was seeing this. It showed me, ayahuasca and mapache showed me this setup, which is like, here's what we actually are, that pure awareness, no consciousness, no this and that, no opposites, no opinions, no stories. That's our blank state. That's the ground of being, the silent witness, the dreamless sleep, the space between thoughts, whatever you want to call it, what we actually are. And then on top of it are these lenses, these layers, these films, or, you know, gels. And this is what they're like when they're separate. And then this is what they're like when they're overlapped. Boom, reality, this. And it was just incredible, the feeling of relief and just straight up joy. Like, oh. And what I interpreted was that these are the senses. You know, you got your senses. You got your sight, taste, smell, touch, hearing, and the imagination, you know, and the mind or whatever. And this is what they're like when they're separate. And this is what they're like when they're overlapping. And what we see is this overlapping vision. If you know, and if you take one away, like you take hearing away, like when I lost, you know, one ear during COVID, if you take hearing away, then that lens is removed. And you get this picture without the sound. If you lose your sight, that filter is gone. You pull that gel out, and then you get this other version of this without the visual element. But that's what it is. It's just this thing built of these like, this thing that we call like reality is just this, you know, collection of these gels. And at death, all of them are removed. And you return to just the state of, you know, I mean, you can't complain about it. There's no you to complain. There's nothing that can be shared about it with you. I can't talk about that state. I can only talk about the returning and what preceded it. You know, that's why we call non-duality non-duality, because you can't say it's oneness, because oneness implies two-ness, and two-ness implies threeness and infinity. You got to just say it's not two things. You can't talk about it directly, just like I can't talk about that state. I can only describe what it wasn't. It wasn't this. So for me, you know, that helped me, that experience, because it was such a stark reminder that, oh yeah, you know, you take all this stuff away, take all of life away, all this filter, you're absolutely fine. There's no worry there. And, you know, so I look at what we got going here in this world as like, it's just a bonus round or something. You get pure awareness plus all this. But don't trip out on the all this. Don't take these lenses, these overlapping gels, as like the thing. It's just extra. And when it leaves, you're back to just, you know, you're totally complete. You know, Rick is totally complete now. He's not worrying about whatever trauma he's been through or whatever things are dissatisfying in his life. He's completely, you know, that's why we say rest in peace. It's like, yeah, it is kind of like sleeping in the sense that, you know, dreamless sleep is nothingness. It's nothingness. And this is nothingness. It just looks like it's not. It's also everything. You know, and I've said it before, I'll say it again. You know, all the pain of life comes from this idea that you're an object in space and time. That's the source of all of it. I'm born and I'm going to die. And in between, I need to get as much good times and avoid as many bad times as I possibly can. He who gets the most toys or adventures wins. Those who have the least lose. It's this ladder of suffering. I'm down here. I want to get up there. These people are below me. These ones are above me. Oh my God, we only have so much time. It's running out. Oh, my, whoa, 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 you know. That's where all the suffering comes from. But if you just take the ladder away and say, no, 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 I'm just life itself. I'm just infinity. That's my actual nature. Then you can get into this thing with less, without that anxiety. You know, anxiety is a past future product. It's a mind game trip that we're on. You don't have to do it. You don't have to. You can do that. You can do it your whole life. You know, it's your life. You do it. Or you can just step outside of that. You're still a part of the flow. You're still in it. You're just in it without this crazy pressure that comes from this, you know, everything being this concept. You know, you're free. You get some freedom finally. That's what happens when you make that break. And here's one of the things I like to do. Okay, I like to give also, when I talk about this stuff, you might think, well, what do you do to get there? Or what, you know, how do you break that spell? And one of the ways you break the spell, I mean, you can do ayahuasca, whatever, that helps maybe, but it's not important. You don't need to by any means. I mean, this idea of seeking spectacular experiences like the one I just described, that's not the thing. It's just the recognition that, and here's one of the things you can do. Okay, like I was saying, a practical thing you can do. This is something I'm giving to you. I do it all the time. I do it a lot. Just whenever you notice life, most mundane time, special time, whatever, just say to yourself, this is the supreme reality. This here now, exactly as it is the supreme reality. Just say that. Notice it. It's the only life you have. It's the only time that actually exists. It works in any circumstance. You're in a boring doctor's office waiting to get seen for a hangnail or whatever. Listening to Lionel Richie on the PA speaker, boring art on the beige walls. Somebody sitting behind a desk over there and at the counter, you know, looking at a computer while you're sitting, looking at your phone. Stop and go, this is the supreme reality. Everything that exists for me, it seems, is this. Everything I've lived has led to this. Everything that is to come springs from this. Everything that is this. You can't argue with that. It's just true. You know, you might be on top of a mountaintop, you know, with ones you love spreading the ashes of your father or something, and you might think, well, this is the supreme reality. It's special. No, no, no. They're all the supreme reality. You're stuck in traffic. You're stressed out. You got to pee. How do you get out? This is the supreme reality. It looks like this right now. This is what the lens, the overlapping lenses present right now. But behind those lenses is always that pure awareness, that ground of being, whatever you want to call it. Words don't go there. But that thing is always present. Always. You know, and that goes for Rick Froberg, whose art and music touched a ton of people, to, you know, somebody whose art or no lack of art never touched anyone. Somebody whose life was lived in quiet solitude, or whose actions and things never, you know, whatever. People whose impact on the world were not positive. They too returned to the ocean. You know, in this story, we want to think of, you know, you go to some spectacular reward after for goodness, and you go to a horrible punishment for badness. That's all story stuff, you know. That's just saying life just continues to go. It's, you know, but that's this whole idea that, like, the afterlife is just a continuation of this thing. This thing isn't a thing. That isn't a thing. It's all. Anything you can talk about is in the imagination. But there's a thing beyond the imagination. That's what I'm getting at. So just notice that's what I'm handing out this time, is saying, just stop whenever it strikes you. Whenever it strikes you, stop and notice. This is the supreme reality. When stuff sucks, notice it. When stuff is good, notice it. And just say it. Say that out loud to yourself or quietly inside. Say it to somebody you love. Hey, did you notice? This is the supreme reality. I don't know. It's something I like to do. Okay, so that's the end of the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. And I celebrate the music and life and art of Rick Froberg, and of all artists living and dead, those yet to be born,
those who don't ever undergo the formality of becoming. I celebrate all of them. And I celebrate you, dear listener, and send my love to all fans of Rick's music and art, all friends and family of Rick, and everybody. Okay, and that's it. Thank you so much. Traeger Method Podcast. We'll be back again soon with a guest that's not me next time. I guess I'm a guest also that's not me. So there will be another episode soon. We're in the 80s now. Thank you so much for being here. Love you. Goodbye.